It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. In Matewan, Donna May Paterino says the town's history may hold the key to its future.
Matewan has so much to offer, and there's you can just name a few small towns across America who have as much rich history as Matewan does.
Jessica Lilly takes us to the annual reenactment of the Matewan Massacre. The story coming up on this West Virginia morning. Lawmakers wrapped up their special session yesterday afternoon, passing 7 bills in total. Those included bills to extend the deadline for electrical inspections at docks and marinas, change the way the state courtesy patrol is funded, and clean up some unintended consequences in a bill raising the minimum wage. However, it's a last-minute amendment to a funding bill in the House that is being questioned by one lawmaker, the only lawmaker to vote against it. Ashton Mara explains.
But I'm here to say don't give up, continue to work, and at the end of the day, truthfully, we will prevail.
That was the message delivered by Senate President Jeff Kessler Tuesday morning to a group of social service advocates. And it was answered more quickly than even he expected. Delegate Brent Boggs speaking on the floor yesterday.
The amendment that is before you will actually reduce one of the items in the supplemental. It would be the licensed racetrack regular purse fund from the $15 million by a total of $1,068,364 for one time, and that would restore the following.
Before we let the finance chairman continue, let's break this down into language that's a little easier to understand. Boggs is talking about an appropriations bill, one that takes excess lottery revenues and gives them to programs the legislature has never funded by appropriation before. Those programs used to be funded by statute, but that changed during March's special session. Now, in its most basic sense, lawmakers need to assign those funds to accounts through this special session bill. Within those newly appropriated accounts are two that supply the horse and dog racetracks with money to pay winners who bet on races, the racetrack purse funds. Boggs's amendment proposes cutting those funds by a little more than $1 million and putting that money in family and child service programs that had recently been reduced by the governor.
If not, the question now is on passage of the bill. All those in favor will vote green. All those opposed will vote red. The clerk will prepare the machine.
And that's exactly what members of the House voted to do. They unanimously accepted the amendment and passed the bill to restore funding to child advocacy centers, family resource networks, and domestic violence prevention programs.
And what we're doing here is, unfortunately, we're taking money from a group of people who did nothing wrong.
Kanawha County Republican Delegate J.B. McCuskey stood to speak on behalf of the racetrack community that's losing funds, but to also thank his fellow delegates for their support of the amended legislation.
And they don't deserve to have their money taken away, but it is being so. And it's being so because we are prioritizing those who are the most vulnerable in our society. And I believe that the government's role, if nothing else, is to make sure that we're protecting the people who can't protect themselves.
Delegate after delegate praised one another for coming up with a solution. But in the Senate, the conversation took a slightly different form. Senator Herb Snyder of Jefferson County raised concerns over where the money was coming from that the House chose to move from the racetracks to social services. Remember I said this money was being appropriated for the first time, whereas before it was distributed through state law? Well, Snyder believes this money is not subject to appropriation, but instead is still protected by statute and can't just be taken from one program and given to another.
My voice in this is not anti-social programs or anything else. This is about where the money's coming from and whether what we're doing is legal. We have an obligation to do that here. And whether it's taking purse money or whether it's taking their money. For instance, if social programs were guaranteed $1 million by statute, we couldn't just arbitrarily give it and appropriate it to somebody else. That's the principle that I'm trying to uphold here, is the principle of law.
Snyder anticipates the breeders from whom the money is being taken will file an injunction in the courts to get that money back. Senate Finance Chairman Roman Prezioso disagrees. He believes the money is able to be appropriated and there is just some confusion over a complicated piece of legislation. He believes there will be no problem with the changing of funding levels. He and his fellow members of the Senate, with the exception of Snyder, voted in favor of the bill. Governor Tomlin says he will likely sign the measure, and he's glad to see lawmakers find a way to restore funding to vital programs outside of the general revenue budget. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
As the school year draws to a close, many schools take advantage of the summer weeks to make changes to everything from curriculum to grounds maintenance. And increasingly, schools are faced with a dilemma of what to do with their aging libraries. As Glennis Borb reports, Wheeling Catholic Central High School is making bold moves.
For the educational community.
Oh, yeah?
You know,
are there plans to that end?
There are plans to eventually be able to perhaps offer classes.
Wheeling Catholic High School's Director of Advancement, Kathleen Baxter, walks through the school that was built in 1960 to the library on the second floor that's already being emptied of books and shelves to make way for a new space.
What we're looking at is the location, which is currently the library at Central Catholic High School. That becomes a question with a lot of high schools and grade schools and even colleges. What do we do with the library space? They're huge spaces of real estate that are kind of debunked. So how do we make it work? How do we make it enhance education in 2014?
The school decided to take a page from MIT, or Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and is renovating this library into a technology-enhanced active learning, or TEAL, lab.
What we know in studies today is that students learn best when they're busy, when they're active, not passive learning. And so that is what this is all about. It is collaborative group effort education.
In lieu of shelves of largely ignored books, workstations, tables to accommodate large and small groups, and a lounge environment will be made complete with wireless tablets and other touchscreens, computer projectors, and other kinds of technological tools.
These windows look out to the hallway. This will be writable glass. Even that will be usable and very much interactive. It's technology-infused education.
Baxter says the lab isn't simply designed for technology and computer classes, though, but instead to accommodate all classes being offered, everything from 3D skeleton software to 3D software to help calculus students envision their projects to video production capabilities. The TEAL lab is designed to extend into multiple rooms as well as enhance the lessons in different classrooms.
So whether it's the Spanish class or whether it's math, science, you name it, they will be able to now augment what they're learning, what they're seeing, capabilities, what this will do for biology, for instance.
Wow.
It's very, very exciting.
It provides the students with a tablet, touch monitor, and space. And I think that's the critical thing. It gives them space and personal responsibility for learning.
That's the school's instructional technology coordinator, Deb Warmoth, who, along with Principal Rebecca Sandcombe, went to visit a TEAL lab that was up and running in a high school in Orlando, Florida, before the decision to move forward with this TEAL lab here. Sandcombe says she and Warmoth were taken by the learning environment they encountered there.
The TEAL lab there, we were so impressed by its functionality. The students were absolutely engaged, and that's what impressed us so much about the space. It wasn't about the bells and whistles, and it wasn't necessarily about the technology. It was about how students were able to maximize their learning through the tools and resources that are available out there in the world to them.
Sandcombe stresses that the lab is part of a new learning initiative throughout the school where they're trying to overhaul the way kids are educated. One-to-one devices, upgraded internet facilities, and improved communication classes and technology will be incorporated throughout the school. She says teachers are all on board and are already moving in that direction within their classrooms.
If you look at an office or you look at any other thing in this world, if you looked at it 50 years ago, it's pretty drastically different now. Mm-hmm. It looks different. When you look at a classroom, It looks the same. And why is that? And how are our students truly maximizing the tools and resources out there available?
Several grants and local donations are making the transformation possible. Principal Sancombe expects the lab to be complete by the time classes begin in the fall. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Wheeling.
And this is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:40. Mostly cloudy skies today with a chance of rain and thunderstorms. Temperatures in the 70s to near 80 degrees. Becoming clear overnight with lows in the 50s. Partly cloudy tomorrow, a little cooler with temperatures in the 60s and 70s. Overnight lows in the 40s. And the outlook for the Memorial Day weekend, mostly sunny. There's a slight chance of rain on Saturday. Temperatures will be in the 70s and 80s.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by the West Virginia Division of Rehabilitation Services, enabling and empowering workers with disabilities to meet business workforce needs. Visit wvdrs.org for employer services.
Monday marked the 94th anniversary of the Battle of Matewan, a showdown between the United Mine Workers of America and Baldwin Felt's detectives hired by coal operators. The Mingo County town marked the anniversary over the weekend with a reenactment. Matewan was recently chosen to be part of the Turn This Town Around project. The county has endured several black eyes over recent months in which a judge and county commissioner were charged with conspiracy. As Jessica Lilly reports, reenactment organizers hope the momentum of the project will help them complete a 14-year-old dream.
As part of the West Virginia Focus magazine's Turn This Town Around project, experts with the West Virginia Community Development Hub are helping Matewan focus, pursue, and execute plans to revitalize the town. Donna Mae Paterino lives in nearby Kentucky, but has organized the Matewan reenactment for the past 14 years. She, like so many involved in the project, think that heritage will play a key role in the revitalization efforts.
I didn't know what happened in Matewan in 1920. And we sure didn't talk about the Hatfield-McCoy feud because of the stereotype that it brought to this area through the media. Well, it's so important once you start researching the events of 1920 and in the early 1900s with the mining industry. It's so important that we teach our children today because they don't realize that they couldn't go down to Walmart and buy their favorite video game in 1920. They have no idea what it would have been like to live on company-owned property and have to shop at the company grocery store, go to the company doctor, go to the company school, and I feel like they need to know.
In the spring of 1920, this area along the Tug River in West Virginia and Kentucky was the front lines in the battle between the coal operators and United Mine Workers of America.
Two men dressed in suits reminiscent of the 1920s begin the Battle of Matewan reenactment by describing the significance of events at the time.
Union or against it, I decided to go with the Union. And in these parts, Sid Hatfield was the Union.
A crowd of about 100 visitors sit and stand under white canopies as they watch and listen to the reenactment. It's unlikely that they found Matewan by mistake. The roads that lead to the small town with a population of less than 500 are riddled with switchbacks as they weave their way up the edge of the mountains, far off the beaten path. The town sits at the foot of towering mountains in the Tug River Valley, so flooding has historically been an issue. So much, in fact, that the late Senator Robert C. Byrd secured federal money to construct a flood wall more than 2,000 feet long, varying in height between 6 and 29 feet above ground. The wall was completed in 1997. While residents claim it worked to protect the town from high water, Paterino says it's kept more than floodwaters out.
Off the beaten path, and people were afraid to come across those railroad tracks and come into town to shop at our businesses. And that's why we've got to focus on our history. That's bringing people here. That's why we've got to do all we can to turn this town around.
The geographic challenges are being addressed in part with the King Coal Highway, an incomplete road that runs close to Matewan. It's an example of public-private partnerships that allow coal companies to mine coal and leave roadbeds for paving. But that's not the only challenge for Matewan. As I traveled along those mountainous roads, I couldn't help but notice the massive, beautiful homes, often with underground pools and slides, sitting near the single-wide mobile homes. More than 30% of residents in Mingo County live below the poverty level, almost double the rate for West Virginia's at nearly 18% poverty rate from 2008 to 2012, according to the U.S. Census Bureau.
This looks like the town that time forgot. That was my first impression. But, you know, I've been here just a couple hours now only, but, you know, the people here are so warm and welcoming.
Claire Webb is an 8th grade West Virginia history teacher at Wildwood Elementary School in Jefferson County. She's visiting Matewan with Coal Country Tours to learn more about the mine wars. For Webb, the trip was humbling. She says Jefferson County is a different West Virginia than Mingo County. As basically a suburb of Washington, D.C., her home county has a different environment socially and economically. The same census report says Jefferson County has more than 50,000 residents with an 11% poverty rate. That's 6% less than the state average.
So it's a very different climate. It's a very different environment socially, economically, for sure. And so when I travel to this part of the state, I'm always struck by the differences in the eastern panhandle of the state versus the rest of the state. I'm humbled as a West Virginian by how we, you know, myself and Mingo Countyans, Wyoming Countyans, McDowell Countyans, we all hail from the same state, but we have such different views of our state. We have different challenges. We have a different perspective. We have different lives in West Virginia, and it's all about where you're from. And in these communities in the southern part of the state, in the coal fields, it really is, I do feel, sometimes an alternate universe. And I'm so grateful to my fellow West Virginians for their love for their state that allows them to live here and deal with these immense challenges that exist on a day-to-day basis with living in a southern coal field.
The only way you boys are going to take me out of this town is dead.
That's the way you want it, Hatfield.
The reenactment climaxes with a gunfight between the hired Baldwin Feltz detectives and the union workers. The mine war reenactment depicts efforts in the coal fields to unionize and demand fair wages and better working conditions. On June 25, 1938, 18 years after the showdown, President Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which established minimum wages, overtime pay, record keeping, and child labor standards for private sector and government workers.
I think just their push and their fight to be treated well and to be treated like human citizens has translated into what we all enjoy automatically today without really a second thought.
Heartache shall come, no more clouds in the sky.
Along with organizing the reenactment, Donna Mae Paterino is also an actress who sings a gospel hymn after describing the death of her son, who died in the gunfight in the drama. Just as the song gives words of hope, Paterino, too, holds to hope for Matewan.
What a day, glorious day, that will be.
Matewan has so much to offer, and there's really, you can just name a few small towns across America who have as much rich history as Matewan does. Very few and far between, and a lot of the small towns are no more. And we've got to hold on to our small town.
The reenactment is performed on the main street in downtown Matewan. Paterino has worked on the drama for 14 years and has been preaching every sermon she can in favor of an amphitheater.
We don't have to limit our shows to 8 or 10 a year. We can teach our history on a regular basis to our young people. We can bring music events in. We can do all sorts of things with an outdoor theater for our young people that we would no other way be able to do.
Paterino says the momentum of the Turn This Town Around project is igniting even more hope for the $300,000 amphitheater dream. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Matewan.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback@wvpublic.org. Follow us on Twitter @wvpublicnews. and find us on Facebook. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Beneduccio. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.